Good morning, all, and welcome to Snohomish County PUD Board of Commissioners meeting. It is 9:00 a.m. on Tuesday, October 18th, 2022. I have with me, I'm Toni Olson, Board President. I have with me this morning Rebecca Wolf, Vice President, Sidney Logan, Secretary, Joe Fina, Acting General Counsel, Pam Bailey, Assistant General Manager, Customer Service, Energy Services, excuse me, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board, Morgan Stolzner, Deputy Clerk of the Board. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please remember to mute or turn off your electronic devices. This session is for the Board and the CEO General Manager to study and discuss issues among ourselves and with PUD staff. I will turn it over now to Pam.
Good morning, Commissioners. We have some updates this morning from our community engagement. Kelly Stickney.
Good morning, Commissioners. It's my pleasure today to be here to give you an update on our first ever Run for Warmth, which happened last Saturday. There are a number of reasons that we decided to sponsor a run for the first time ever. One, it was a great way to connect with our community. Obviously, we got to support the goal of increasing health and physical activity, and it was a fundraiser for our Project Pride program. So as I mentioned, the first run was last Saturday. We had over 1,800 participants come. It was the biggest run they have ever had. And I'd like to think that's because of our first time sponsorship of the event. I wanted to show you real quick a few of the things that we got as part of our sponsorship. One was the PUD logo on this amazing medal that our runners and walkers got. And then there were 1,800 people running through Snohomish with our logos on their back and on the front. So it was an amazing thing to see. We raised $1,252 for Project Pride, which will go to help low-income families in need of assistance with their energy bills this winter. I'd like to make a few thank yous. One, I want to thank everyone who used our code for the run, which allowed us to raise those funds for Project Pride. I'd like to thank all of our members of Team PUD who ran or walked in the race and who recruited their family and friends to do the same. I'd also like to thank all of our volunteers for the race who also helped us raise money for Project Pride, and those members of Team PUD that came out to support those runners and walkers, including our facilities team, Jeff Feinberg, Brenda White, Heather Herbst, Andrea Duffy, Krista Rasmussen, Yanni Avatare, Jason Sikowski, Tracy Anderson, Trevor Velasco, Carrie Trimble, Colleen Murphy, and Aaron Sweeney. It was an amazing effort by Team PUD, a wonderful opportunity to energize life in our communities. We're already planning for next year, and we're hoping for even more participation from Team PUD and to raise even more funds for Project Pride. So thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Wonderful. Sounds like we had a big hit. I saw a lot of that, a lot of presence on social media about the run, so the word got out there. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you, Billy. Next, we have our legislative. If you have a chance to read and have any questions, we have some thoughts in here.
I don't see any changes from the previous report. Yes, this. Showing up every month now. I thought our sequence had more time in between reports, and maybe we're getting into the legislative, pre-legislative, and it's now weekly, or month, twice a month.
We're getting those once a month now through the election, and
okay.
then we'll hold back to our old schedule.
Okay.
With the election season, there's a little less to report on official activities. It's mostly campaign activities, although as you're seeing in that report, where there's an uptick in activity now as we're all getting ready to face January again.
I do have one question. I saw the county is looking at improvements on the interurban trail. I'm curious if it's just, if it's not passable there, or it just is in bad shape, or, then I'm curious also, who owns those improvements after they've been done, do we own them?
These are all very good questions. Unfortunately, Brenda White's not here today.
I can actually answer those. Morning, Barnes Real Estate Manager. And actually, the improvements that they're doing are what they're calling missing links. And it's just areas where people then have to go onto an arterial road. So it makes it a little dangerous. So none of this is actually going to take place on our property, but they're going to do some bypasses, overpasses, walkways, so it keeps the people off of the busy traffic.
Wonderful, thank you.
Commissioner, did you have any questions?
No, I was just thinking that I remember that when the trail goes through a town, the city has ownership of that land, right? No, we have a right of way, right?
But we own it.
Okay.
We own the land, and we contract with the cities to maintain it and provide security so that they can have the trail.
Correct. We have agreements, trail easements with all of the municipalities.
Uh-huh.
And so as it goes through, yes, we are still the fee owner of it, but they do have an easement to utilize it as a trail.
And the cities have the easement. Okay.
Yes, actually, City of Everett, Snohomish County, City of Linwood, and City of Mount Lake Terrace.
Right. Well, thank you.
Let's move on.
Okay, next we have a presentation for the Washington State Department of Transportation easement with Heidi Waxham.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm out of control with this here. So I am going to tell you about a Sorry about that. So we have an agreement with Washington State Department of Transportation that we'd like to move forward with. The district currently has some easements on parcels that the owner would like to need to be able to convey portions of their property to WashDOT for 524. And the district does have easements in portions of the area that's going to be dedicated. However, there are sections of that that are surplus to the needs of the district. So we do have some facilities within the area to be dedicated. And so we'd like to move forward with an agreement with WashDOT that we would do a partial extinguishment on that area, and in exchange get an easement from WashDOT for the portions that do contain facilities that the district needs to maintain an easement on. And so there's a little bit of the background here that the existing easements are as built. All the facilities have been installed, and we do have a survey description of those, their exact location now. So there will be two different transactions here. There'll be one that's the partial extinguishment of the surplus area. That will be a surveyed description that will allow us to surplus the entire dedicated area from those parcels, and then they will currently record the easement that will have a survey description of the facilities within the conveyed area. Here's a visual depiction of the entire area that's going to be conveyed from the owner of the property to WashDOT. And this is a small area that contains facilities that district needs to be able to maintain an easement for. So here's just some overview to there won't be any facilities that are not covered by easement. This has been reviewed and by legal, as well as our group, obviously, and the engineering area that's responsible for this section. And I'll have approved that, this is fine to move forward with. So we're hoping that we'll be able to have a public hearing on November 1st and vote resolution. Are there any questions?
Do you have any questions, Commissioner?
I don't know, thank you.
Hannah, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you, Heidi. Next, we have from Energy Services, Sherry Miller, and she's here to talk about the PSC Master Service Agreement.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Sherry Miller, and I'm a...
Thank you.
This slide just changed itself. And I'm a Program Manager for Customer and Energy Services. And with me is Jeff Feinberg. He's a Senior Manager with Energy Efficiency and Customer Innovations. And we're here to talk with you about the Master Service Agreement with PSC. So basically, the agreement is, the Master Service Agreement has proven to be a very successful partnership with PSC. By the end of this year, 2022, the current MSA not to exceed $2 million will be nearly accounted for in our programs, with the agreement continuing through February 24. The initial amount of $2 million allowed us the space to explore opportunities, and the success of the program has identified additional opportunities to use the agreement to serve our mutual PSC customers. Excuse me. The Small Business Direct Install Program is the first program in the MSA, and it serves a historically underserved market segment and provides meaningful benefits at a critical time for small businesses navigating the pandemic and beyond savings alone. To continue the Small Business Direct Install Program and allow MSA funding for additional programs, increased funding is needed. So our ask is consideration of the commission for approval to increase the MSA not to exceed by $1.5 million and for resolution at the next commission meeting. The funds would carry us through 2023 and into early 2024, and it would support the Small Business Direct Install Program, the Energy Design Assistance Program, which is new to the MSA this year. It would support program growth for both of these programs, and it would also give us capacity for new programs to come in. Yes.
So could you say a little more about the Small Business Direct Install? What is a direct install? I mean, I should know, I guess. But...
So it's a good question. Basically, we work with small businesses,
right,
and we install energy efficiency measures into their businesses, and they have an assessment. We have a third-party company that goes out and works directly with them and does the installs, and they will do an assessment for the business and evaluate what their needs are and what could support them with energy efficiency.
Thank you. I did see that wonderful graphic with all the kinds of businesses that
yes.
are but I still wasn't sure what is a direct install.
It's a good question.
Okay. Thank you.
So a little about the background for the MSA is the commission approved it July 7th, 2020. The agreement was executed on November 9th, 2020. And it's important to note that it took about 10 years of effort between the utilities to develop this agreement and create this program that could be launched. So 11-9 was a momentous day. And the agreement expires February 28th, 2024, with the current limit of $2 million. And as mentioned, the first program was the Small Business Direct Install, or the Small Business Program, and it essentially started the day the agreement was executed. Everything was ready and off we went. So So there's many benefits to the agreement. Several of them include utility coordination for energy conservation and delivery of energy savings. It enables both the PUD and PSE shared customers to receive full value for energy savings. And it allows us to buy and sell savings between the utilities if savings becomes harder to achieve. This is the page you were referring to, Commissioner Wolf. And this is a great overview of the program, just in one slide. Historically, small businesses have been a very difficult segment for us to reach. And we define them as having 10,000 square foot maximum of conditioned or heated space. So on the left is a small variety of the many businesses that go through this program. And we've had everything from childcare to meat lockers, pet grooming, restaurants, offices, medical facilities, you name it, it's included in the list. And the program has worked through a number of our cities in Snohomish County, which are listed on the right. So it's nice to see we're all over the county. A little report card for the small business direct install and kilowatt hour savings. And in 2020, which was less than 2 months, maybe more like about 4 or 5 weeks, we pulled in 633,797 kilowatt hours. So there was a huge pent up demand for this program to launch. And then 2021 was our first full year. And that brought in 1,353,745 kilowatt hours. And then this year, 2022, at the 6 month mark, we were at 733,616. And we have expectations to be just shy of 1.8 million by the end of the year. So it continues to grow every year. So the many different businesses that you saw on that slide that go through, one of them is Habitat for Humanity, which you're probably familiar with. And this slide is a little bit of the story of their experience with the program. COVID-19 caused their stores to close in that first year of the pandemic, and they lost more than $300,000 in revenue, which is devastating for any small business. They depend on store sales to fund affordable homes for low-income families. So by participating in the Small Business Direct Install program, they were able to receive about 23,000 in efficiency upgrades. Stephen Lee is the director of Habitat of Humanity in Snohomish County, and he said this: high efficiency LED lighting equipment installed will save our organization $7,538 every single year in electricity bills. This enabled us to put the entirety of our energy savings into housing solutions for local families. So it's a wonderful story. And I think before we go to questions, I'll just ask if Jeff has anything to add.
Just a couple questions.
Hi, Jeff Feinberg, Senior Manager of Energy Services and Customer Innovations. And I think the comments that I would like to make on this is, you know, we had mentioned in there, we're asking for is the approval to lift the not to exceed amount, an additional 1.5 million. And part of that was whenever we put the agreement forward back in 2020, is we set the $2 million limit because we weren't really sure how many programs we were going to fit underneath this agreement. And we kind of wanted to test the waters on both sides with PSE and ourselves. And as you can see, what we found was that there was a lot of opportunity with being able to sell savings to and from one another through this kind of an agreement. And so it's kind of an exciting opportunity to come and say, hey, we need to lift the not to exceed amount because this has been so successful. And so one of those things that our customers have really enjoyed. But we're also excited to be bringing in a second program, which Sherry mentioned, the Energy Design Assistance Program, which has been so successful for us that PSE is actually onboarding the program themselves. And they'll be managing their own version of the energy design assistance. But in the meantime, this agreement is allowing some of our projects that are already underway where there are therm savings for PSE to be able to capture those therm savings. And so I think just across the board, this has been really successful But from an investment and value standpoint, I think the thing we're really excited about is this is allowing PSE customers and our customers to get the most of those different investments that are being made for both utilities on their behalf. And so with that, I could go on and on, but we're really excited about it. Sherry's done a really good job with CorpCom as well, putting a lot of other customer testimonials on our website. And so we shared about Habitat here, but there's some other really good stories on the website of small businesses that have just said, you know, it's been a game changer for them and allowed them to kind of keep the doors open and do more than they expect.
Bravo. That's great.
Question? Yeah, well, first of all, impressive outcome. That's wonderful that you're back 2 years early. That we're doing so well. So is PSE, are they happy with the program? Is it working for them as well?
Yes. So with the Small Business Direct Install, they've had that program for about 10 years. And that's part of what started the conversation. It's been so successful for us. How about if you think about it as well? We'd see benefit for you. So they've their territory is very large, and they are all over the territory with their small businesses. And it's still, after 10 years, is a very strong program.
So I know we probably talked about this, probably answered this question 2 years ago, but trying to understand the relationships. The way I understand it is the third party goes out to look at a business and looks at the possible projects. Some may be natural gas savings, some may be electricity savings. And then the projects that are done just depend on the viability and what the owner chooses.
Yes.
So they may go to a place and they only find the gas savings, and they may do only like a lighting improvement, like in this example. Is that right?
Yeah, most of the savings have been electric
okay.
in our territory.
Yeah.
I think PSC sees more gas savings in their territory, but we still have joint customers. And so the customer has a choice. They get the free assessment and they will just survey the entire business and suggest what would help to give them more energy efficiency. And some of the measures are no cost and some are low cost. And then the business decides if they want to move forward. And if they do, the installer comes in, schedules, and installs the measures.
I would imagine these small businesses are a very rich field. You know, when I worked at the school district, we did like relighting projects, but we had staff that, you know, did maintenance and improvements. But small business doesn't necessarily have that kind of, so making it easy for them really makes a lot of sense. That's just wonderful.
And our timing was so perfect. We've been working on this for years. And then we start in the first year of a pandemic, and which businesses are hit so hard as the small businesses. So it was just really beautiful timing that we could start this program that year.
Is there a program like this for residences, non-businesses?
That's a great question. Jeff, I don't know if you want to take that.
No.
Not yet.
Right? Yeah, not yet.
Okay.
What I will say is we do have inspectors on our staff that are able to go out and do home audits, and they have periodically from time to time. We are currently working on a proposal where we would have a similar program for residential homeowners. We're looking at for low and moderate income families, and that's how we're constructing the program at this time.
Okay, good. Thank you.
And just how is PSE feeling about this? I would just also add that they're also really excited about bringing in the second program, the Energy Design Assistance, because I think one of the things we're all experiencing, we're in a very good position with where we're at with our savings goals for state of Washington, but I think all of the utilities in the region are kind of looking at some of our goals and targets and starting to find it more expensive and more difficult to meet those goals. And so I was just on a conversation with PSE yesterday, and we were talking about how kind of these innovations and different ways to acquire savings are just going to continue to become more and more important for us and PSE as well.
So may I ask one other design assistance? So these would be the consultants who work on energy efficiency designing, is that?
That's correct. And so that program, and I believe we'll be sharing about that in an upcoming presentation as well. But that's where we work with our partner, and we go in whenever there's a new construction project that's commercial or multifamily. Mm-hmm. And we work with the customer, their architects, and our vendor at the design stage so that they provide basically like a menu of three different options above code to make the project more efficient. And so we're able to do that at the new construction step, which is so critical because over time, those retrofits are gonna be way more expensive and sometimes less valuable. So our vendor goes in and works with the architects at design and says, okay, here's a variety of options based on what your goals are of ways you can make this project even more efficient. And so that's how we do it.
It's going to be interesting with some of the upcoming state laws that are being debated right now, you know, for requiring heat pumps into new buildings by a certain date. So I guess maybe PSC might not be thrilled with that. Maybe that's not a good question. Yes. I don't know.
I don't have a comment on that one, but I will say that we're really excited about this program and what it's done for us.
Thank you.
And what we think it'll continue to do as we see a lot of new load growth in our territory.
Thank you.
One last question. It's I know Cascade Natural Gas is part of our territory. Have they shown any interest in participating in a program like this?
Not that I'm aware of. So this program was brought to us from PSC, and we haven't approached them, and they haven't approached us, so it's a good thought.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Good presentation. Pam?
Yes. So next we have Garrison Marr to share a briefing on the BPA contracts.
Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning.
My name is Garrison Marr, and I'm the senior manager of Power Supply, and I'm joined virtually through the ceiling. If you're watching the Zoom meeting, you probably can't appreciate that we have the ceilings where Marie Morrison will help with the tail end of this slide deck. And I'm also supported by Ian Hunter, in our power supply team, if there's, you know, additional questions for this presentation. And what we're hoping to do today is to provide an overview of where we are in the post-2028 BPA power contract negotiation, share what some of our priorities are, how we're addressing those priorities, and talk through some of the next steps. So I know commissioners are getting information on what the region's doing, through PPC and other trade groups, and this is an opportunity to talk about, you know, what's most important to us so that we have shared visibility. And as we get into later stages of this process, you know, we'll already have that grounding of what our priorities are and what's really important to make right. So that's the purpose of today's meeting, and I will click this next slide, talk through the agenda to help us get there. So first, we're going to start with just the contract context and the scope. We'll talk through those priorities that I mentioned, and we'll talk through those next steps. And today, we're just doing an informational briefing, so there's no decisions that need to be made. There's no staff recommendation to respond to or to react to. Just want to make sure that we're on the same page. So I will launch right into it. And we'll start with the post-2028 BPA contract. What really are we talking about when we're talking about this contract? And I'll start with something melodramatic just to raise some eyebrows and get some interest here. You know, we spend about $240 million per year on BPA power. We have a 20-year contract right now. It's not inconceivable that this contract that we're renegotiating now could be a 20-year contract at similar scale of cost. It could be a $4.8 billion contract that we're talking about now. So the details, the priorities, all of the pieces that this contract entails are extremely important to us and our customers. And that's why, you know, we've dedicated a large staff investment in making sure that we're tracking every possible part of this contract and showing up and advocating for our customers' best interests. So it's a big deal. And here's what the contract includes. And I'm a big when, why, how, where kind of guy. So that's kind of how this is organized. You know, the first part is the contract allocations, right? So this is how much can the PUD get at a tier one rate? You might ask, what's a tier one rate? That is the BPA power at BPA's cost. Sometimes this is below the market value, right? Today it is. We have market prices in and around $70 on an annual basis. BPA's power's cost is about $35. Sometimes BPA's cost can be above the market. So we know what it is. That's the positive. It can change over time. The other piece is the product definition. So what power products can the BPA or can PUD get? Today, we get the slice block product. But there's also a standalone block product and a load following power product. So the next contract will determine what our choices are as well. And we want to make sure those are the best possible choices for us to make. We'll also have a process that defines how rates will be set in the next contract or what the price of these products in our allocation will be. That could look like a new construct. Relative to what we're used to. And so we need to track that extremely closely too. And then there are a number of other contract parameters that this contract will include that will be important to us, what we do and how we do it. So one is the federal system size. So if that federal system size has been shrinking, there's some choices that could be made about that federal system size in the future. How the conservation program will work. I'm sure in our budget presentation, you will appropriately hear how we get a good share of reimbursement back from BPA from the great work that our energy services folks do in acquiring conservation. So that'll be a part of what this new contract is. And then the residential exchange program. And probably again in that budget presentation, you'll be hearing how our residential customers get a billing credit through that program. You know, that's also on the table for this next contract. So it's a big scope, and it encompasses these core parts of what our relationship is with BPA outside of the transmission products that we purchase.
Kirsten, is transmission part of the power contract? Or is that another contract, or how does transmission?
Yeah, it's outside of the power contract. And so our point-to-point transmission, you know, we'll be up to make the next decisions on that in 2026. So they need to work together, and we have a timing that'll make sure that happens. The biggest thing is we want to make sure that our transmission portfolio is consistent with the future BPA product that we'll get. We need to work together, but they are separate processes.
It's interesting the timing is different. You'd think the timing would be the same because you need to know what you have with one to make the other work.
Yeah, it would be terrific if they were linked a little bit more deliberately, but the timeline still works for us.
Okay.
Essentially, we'll be asked to sign power contracts in 2025. 2026, we're going to be, you know, on the transmission side doing something really similar.
Thank you.
I get from this whole slide that these are going to be tough negotiations, number one, but to just kind of open up the door crack in terms of we may see something slightly different coming before us. It's not going to be business as usual.
I think it will be evolved business as usual.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So we are, you know, kind of starting from the contract that we have and looking at the, you know, evolutions that make sense from BPA and customers' perspectives of what needs updating and you know, what that looks like. So we don't expect a carbon copy of what we've got, but we do expect it to be built from the contract that we hold today, which is a positive thing.
Thank you.
Hey, well, I am clearly doing the talking too long bit that I tend to do here, so I'm going to try and pick up the pace for you. And this is just to share with our philosophical approach to the contract negotiations, which can be tough, and to make sure that we're on the same page about what that looks like. So the first part is that we as PUD staff are really striving to be solutions-oriented leaders in the development of the best possible contract and product parameters. We are making a big staff commitment to this, multiple hours per week, multiple staff per meeting. What solutions-oriented leaders means to me is that we are developing proposals, we are developing coalitions around proposals, we are trying to be proactive in helping create positive contract and product outcomes that will help our customers. We're not necessarily sitting back and reacting to proposals as they come through those channels. The other is that we are approaching product discussions as if the PUD could be any BPA Power product customer. So today we're a Block Slice customer. We want to make sure that all three of what we think will be the product options are the best possible product options that will let us as the PUD make the best possible selection for our customers. So that's the approach that we're taking there. You know, our goals are the same as they are with just about everything on the power supply side. We're looking for reliable, low cost, flexible, and clean BPA power. We do think that there are some potential changes that are needed to check all of those boxes, and we are pursuing those things. The last piece is, we said that this contract will be built on, you know, the frame of the old contract, and we know that the world's changing. So we need a contract that reflects the future ahead of this, of us, whether that means, you know, Western Resource Adequacy Program, whether that means future markets, whether that means future or existing regulatory obligations that we have. So we need to make sure the contract reflects that. Commissioner Wolf.
So at the PPC and PNUP meetings, some of the members are expressing their desire that BPA would do more in the area of new renewable resources. And so I'm assuming, but I don't want to, are you alluding to more kinds of renewable energy perhaps, and maybe getting us off of coal and that sort of thing? Or getting BPA, not us, but well, as a customer, we're getting a little bit also.
Yeah, you know, we'll address that when we get into these contracts. So I'll show you where that shows up and how that fits into our priorities, absolutely. Okay. But just in case it's helpful, you know, BPA's portfolio is their assets, which are all clean, plus, you know, the small amount of market exposure that they have to balance the system. So that's what their portfolio is today. And then as we get into this presentation, we'll talk about what we're hoping for to make that cleaner.
Peterson, as we look at this, do we have to also sort of predict what other Bonneville customers will do for the load following, state load following? It seemed like the pie is only so big. We know how the pie is divided now, but we don't necessarily know how the pie will be, you know, people will make different choices for 2028. I think, you know, in Washington, I can see perhaps utilities changing. Is that part of the calculus of?
That's one of the parts of the calculus, absolutely. We do think that, you know, it'll be much less likely that folks move from load following to other products. We are seeing some of the slice block folks already post-2028, just to have a using sentence fragment there, already moved from slice block to load following. So let's talk about our priorities, and we've been calling them the four C's, and these are the things that we want to make sure that we get absolutely right for the best interests of our customers. You know, you mentioned the negotiations are tough. There's, you know, more than 140 BPA customers that all have their own priorities. So we need to stay focused on ours, clear about what we need, and then address those things. So the first part is contract high watermark. This is the allocation on an annual basis of BPA's system to us. So we're looking for the largest practical and principled allocations. We'll talk more about each of these and what that means and how we're doing it. But this is our first priority. Our second priority is that we would like to get a 100% clean BPA power product. It'll help us with our future regulatory compliance needs and could significantly decrease our customers' costs. We're also looking to get sufficient clean capacity from BPA to meet load service needs across BPA power products. It's clear how that works from a load following product perspective. We're seeking enhancements for the block product and the slice block product that will help us in a new world that could have a Western resource adequacy program. And last, as always, you know, we're looking for low cost. So contractual structure that gives us low, stable, predictable rates so that we can do that planning for our customers and plan for the future ahead. So those are our priorities. We'll walk through here in a little bit of detail what that looks like. And each slide's gonna have this same structure to it, right? What are we really talking about? What are our unique needs? What makes us different in some cases? What are the pathways to solutions and how have we engaged? So for the first one, contract high watermark, we talked before, this is the annual allocation of BPA power. And Commissioner Olson and Commissioner Logan, you guys correctly identified that it's a BPA pie, and this is really about the slices of the pie. And so we're all on the same page. You know, in fiscal year 2026, we expect BPA customers' net requirements to be in and around 7,400 average megawatts. The system size today is 6,954 average megawatts. So clearly, right, there's more people interested in the pizza than there are slices of that pizza to give out. That's where the dynamic tension is. For us, as we think about how the system's been allocated in the past, it's been on the basis of net requirements, and we've been acquiring a lot of conservation to lower our load and lower our net requirements. So there's two things that can help us address our unique UD needs. The first one is an appropriate accounting of conservation in the calculation. So we've had in the contract that we hold an accounting of conservation that adjusts upwards net requirements to account for essentially what BPA in the region asked us to do, which is acquire conservation so that we stay within our means of a finite BPA power system. So that's one thing that we can and are working on is to make sure that that calculation accounts for as much of the good conservation work that we've done as possible. The other is that, you know, we can also seek to limit regional load growth. It's in that contract high watermark calculation. That's part of BPA's proposal, and that's something that we're doing the math on and making sure that we understand how it all works for our customers and for the region. The last piece, if the first two pieces are about slicing the pie, the last piece is about growing the pie. And Commissioner Wolf, you mentioned this, you know, at PPC meetings, there's been some discussion about, you know, can we cost effectively increase BPA system? What would those resources look like? And what's the, you know, kind of carbon content of those resources? So we've been helping develop the math and peer review the math about what that looks like. We do think that it's possible to increase the system size at a minimal cost and keep a high clean content to BPA system through physical power resources, which is a great thing. So that's a contract high watermark. How we've engaged is we're in PPC's small working group helping to develop the concepts that get sent to BPA from public power. We contributed to the first contract concept paper, writing some sections in there. We serve on the conservation subcommittee, and we've had many meetings directly with BPA staff and administration, moving our issues forward and participating in their process. That's contract high watermark, and I'll come up for air and see if there's any questions on that priority.
My only question about the contract high watermark is, obviously, with climate change, the amount that's going to change. And so are they proposing some kind of rolling average or something in previous years? I mean, is there some, it seems like there's some logical way to agree on what that could be that's based on science?
There is. Science with an editorial asterisk, but they have updated what the definition of firm critical water is for the BPA system. It used to be based on 1937 water, which is the worst hydrology that's been recorded. It's not now. It's based on the 10th percentile of the rolling 30-year average of hydrology. So that was a deliberate attempt to capture changing hydrology into the future. It's not a forecast basis of what climate change could be, which is where I'm putting that editorial asterisk, but it is, you know, an attempt to address that more directly than the 1937 reference. Great. So that was C1. C2 is carbon, and this one's pretty straightforward. You know, BPA has a pretty great carbon content today. It's over 95% clean, but we'd like access to a BPA product that's 100% clean. And for us at the PUD is a large utility subject to I-937 and CETA. There are some unique benefits to us if we can get to 100% clean early. It can help us reduce our customers' costs for regulatory compliance across the programs. And that's one of our motivations for helping to get to 100% clean. We also know that our customers, especially some of our larger corporate customers, are trying to do this on their own. And this is a way to help them get there. So we are looking at rate-making constructs that could help us align environmental attributes, energy, and products. So this could be something like a tier two type product with a known resource backing that could be 100% clean, and different ways to assign environmental attributes to the products that customers want to purchase from BPA. That's what we're working on with BPA. We've also been looking at exchange mechanisms that could help customers exchange between themselves, those with an appetite for 100% clean and those that may not, attributes so that we can match energy and environmental attributes and BPA power to help us meet our goals. So we've developed some of these concepts. We've put them forward to public power, to BPA. We're in the BPA or the PPC concept paper, and we continue to have direct outreach with BPA staff and administration. The last of the C's that I'll present, because Marie's going to come through for the last one here, is capacity. And capacity just broadly, right, is the ability to dispatch energy up or down based on our load patterns or our renewable integration needs. And clean capacity is rare, difficult to develop, and is extremely attractive. We can get that from BPA. So if you've been following the power supply show for the last several years, you know that we've been looking to address seasonal capacity deficits that we can have in adverse weather. And so we would like to continue on that path and see if we can get those addressed in this contract with BPA. And we also think that with the Western Resource Adequacy Program, there's new needs for it, and there's new potential obligations of our relationship with BPA to help us get to those things in a post 2028 contract. So we are hoping through our work to make sure that all BPA power contracts can help address some of these peak load service needs so that we really do have three viable products to look at post 2028 to holistically meet what our customers' needs could be. Done a lot of work here. We've helped author a white paper from the Slice group, which I know there was a lot of pizza references earlier. This is not that Slice. This is the BPA Block Slice product group, contributed to PEC Small Working Group. We're on the Peak Net Requirement Task Force that BPA stood up, and we've been engaging directly with BPA staff and administration. So this is one where we're trying to get as much flexible, clean capacity as we can to help meet our future needs. Marie, if you are out there on the Zoom call, we might move to you after Commissioner Olson's question.
Just a quick question. I'm looking at this, but I'm assuming that the market still has a role in this.
Absolutely.
Off the market occasionally. The less we can, the better that is. But in looking at all of these things, am I making the right assumption that we're still going to have to go, or Bonneville will go to the market?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
From a carbon perspective, we're looking at, are there ways to differentiate across the products, you know, kind of what that market exposure, market attribute looked like?
Okay.
There's different ways to get there. And from the capacity side as well, you know, we are exposed to the market today. We manage it just fine. We've had flat rates now for a number of years. So that market exposure, you know, is something that we're used to managing. We're looking to get the best possible contract and product from BPA to help mitigate some of that future exposure.
So relating to that and related to Commissioner Olson's very interesting question. So this is complicated, I think, because we are looking at a number of other programs that are outside of BPA. And so I'll be interested to follow how you figure that out in terms of, so when you talk about capacity, does that mean excluding these other programs like the RAP and the California ISO and other kinds of programs that we participate in with other regions? And, you know, so that's what I'll be seeking to understand better. How do those programs play into the BPA capacity?
Yeah, that's a great question. That probably, you know, from the RAP program, maybe one way to say it is the RAP program really sets a bar, but it doesn't provide a resource. And that bar that it sets is how much capacity should everybody have so that collaboratively our region can its load service obligations and mitigate the risk of blackout. So the RAP program's given us the bar. In this contract, we'd like to have more tools to help us meet the bar, the resources that would help you get to that level. And for Commissioner Olson's point, we could do that with the market, other resources, or BPA. This is an opportunity for us to get us, you know, as much of that bar addressed through BPA.
Well, I'm thankful that we have such good brains working on this.
It's a big team, and we've got a good one, for sure.
And it would seem that this is the reason to make sure that all three products would fit our needs if we chose to use it, because it seemed like capacity could potentially be, I mean, I'm just thinking that as, you know, with a high watermark number, the difference of, you know, almost 500 in there, It would seem that there may be less Slice available in the future. That would be, because Slice is sort of that amount that's sort of over that, right? So it seems like more people have taken advantage of the free, not the free, the no carbon power
it seemed like. So I can see that this is a challenge, this capacity is a challenge for us. And then when you satisfy the carbon-free aspect, it seems like it becomes a more difficult challenge.
It's a circular puzzle, for sure. And we're taking a holistic view. BPA is long capacity. So we're really looking to see, you know, what's BPA's relationship with customers? What can it be in the next contract? We know what our needs are. And so clearly articulating that to BPA and offering proposals and solutions to help check those boxes for us is really how we're trying to do that.
It would also seem like block size customers all have different needs. And Seattle is a block size customer.
They're just a block customer
just
in Seattle.
Who are the block size customers? Is it just a handful?
Yeah, there is about 10 of them now, and I would probably fail the pop quiz, but some of the largest ones besides ourselves are, you know, Tacoma, UEB or Eugene Water and Electric Board, and a couple of the folks out there at the Mid-Seas, so Cowlitz, Franklin, those folks.
Well, that's a lot to swallow.
It is, but you know, this is something that our staff is, you know, all hands on deck, and we're all over this. So you're there for our folks for sure.
And the bottom line effect is on our customers.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Marie, I'm gonna try and virtually hand this off to you. Let me know if you can narrate this next slide here on cost.
Very good. Thanks, Garrison. Can you hear me okay? Can you hear me okay?
A little bit, please.
Hello, can you hear me?
It's a little faint, Marie, if there's any wizardry you can do on the microphone there.
Yeah. How about that? Is that better? No?
Yes.
That's better?
Yes.
Perfect. Thank you. Thanks, Garrison. Good morning, commissioners. This is Marie Morrison, Principal Utility Analyst in the Power Supply Department, joining you virtually today. Thanks for having me. So to pick up from Garrison, the last of the four C's for today is cost. And what do we mean by cost? In the BPA post-2028 context, what we really mean by cost is low stable prices from BPA to ensure price certainty, not only for the district, but for our customers. And out of the four C's, this is one that is not unique to PUD. This is a shared public power goal. Us being a not-for-profit utility, we want to assure that we give our customers the most affordable power. And where do we see the solution here? Well, under the post-2028 initiative umbrella is a rate design or rates methodology process. And that is where we will push on and see creative solutions in order to solve this big ticket item in the post-2028 contract. So far, we haven't engaged in that process yet because it hasn't started. The process will kick off in the summer of 2023. And for everybody probably already know, this is not our first rodeo. We have experts on the tiered rates methodology, and we will leverage that expertise and really engage and invest in this process so that we are assured that we're giving the most affordable power for our customers. Any questions on this slide, commissioners?
Yeah.
I have a question. So does Bonneville's profitability weigh into this too? I mean, for instance, you know, this they've been able to sell a lot of power on the market, and that's going to benefit all their customers. Does that math weigh into this cost and how the contract turns out?
It does. The way that that showed up for us is Bonneville's net secondary revenues. Right. And the rate-making constructs by which some of those revenues were returned to us and by which some of those revenues were used to reduce Bonneville's debt and reduce its future costs and supplement, some of the operational, or reduce some of the operational costs. So in the next construct, they could do something different with net secondary revenues. Right now it's on a forecast basis. Distributions are kind of the misses of the forecast due to market forces. Those things could change. And when they do, it's important to us that those changes result in really stable rates for customers and really predictable and appropriate constructs so that those benefits are still shared with customers. So that's an example of what we're looking for in this next part of the process that'll kick off probably in November, December, to make sure that the changes that they could make are appropriate and still reflect our customers' best interests.
I guess what I was asking is there things that can be done in the contract to increase net secondary revenues? I'm not so much worried about how they get allocated. I'm just curious about ways to make Bonneville more profitable so its effective cost is less.
There probably are, but Bonneville probably can't do them alone. And maybe the headline would be future capacity will be a really important regional commodity. Future energy might look a little different if Bonneville sells more capacity.
Okay. Isn't he tech?
Energy.
That is a wordy headline.
But those are market changes,
yeah,
right? So those market changes BPA can't do on its own.
It just seems like we're, the new contract, 20-year contract, maybe. It seems like there's, California is desperately needing our power at times, and that should come at, cost to them, a benefit to those of us that own the hydro system. So I'm just sort of wondering how all that calculus works out, and then with offering slice products, so which is helpful to us going ahead in the future if power prices are high. Just trying to understand in big scope, if there's any look at that. I think you answered the question. Maybe is the answer.
Maybe is the answer.
Thank you.
Marie, can I change it to the next steps slide for you?
Yes, please. Thanks, Garrison. Right. So what are next steps from BPA's perspective? So BPA is looking at the post-2028 piece of the whole initiative, the umbrella initiative, as a three-phase process. For right now, we're in the policy stage. We know that BPA released the concept paper in July of this year. And right now, BPA is holding a lot of workshops that will continue until March 2023. So what I want to tell all of you is now is the time to influence. And we're really doing that. Our team is really doing the engagement process. The draft policy is expected to be released in spring of 2023. And then after that will be the final policy and draft. The next phase of the process will be contract development, which will be later during the course of the development. So it will kick off in January 2024 through December. And then the last phase will be to make sure that systems are ready and able to execute that contract. That would be the last phase of the process from BPA's perspective. Next slide, please. So this slide is what PUD is doing now that the concept paper has been released, workshops are being held. From our perspective, we are really making sure that we're advancing the four C's that you heard this morning: contract high watermark, carbon capacity, and cost. And there's not a dearth of venues to do that. We have engaged on the PPC realm. We have engaged with our SLICE peers. We have engaged with BPA staff, and at the executive level, our John H. has talked to BPA's John H. We're all over the place, to say the least. So we're making sure that we're advancing the PUD's interests in this process. But that's not all. Just advancing the four C's in these outside venues is not enough. We have additional efforts that we're doing inside the PUD. And what are these efforts? One is to make sure that we're not only analyzing the contract, the future contract, with the contract that we have right now, which is the SLICE block product. As Garrison mentioned earlier in the presentation, we're taking a holistic view and analyzing the contract from other product perspectives as well. And we're doing that in the 2023 IRP process. I also mentioned that under the post-2028 initiative umbrella are other processes. And one of the processes is the rates methodology process. Legal and power supply are engaging in this process as well. We had the first workshop on September 27th, and there's one forthcoming workshop next week. So we're following that closely. And then we also have a cross-functional group that we give status updates to every now and then. We call it the cross-functional big tent group. We had our meeting yesterday. And what this is a group of subject matter experts that share their perspectives on the BPA contract. In this group are energy services, CorpCom, reliability and compliance, legal. So we share our views to make sure that we capture different perspectives as we engage with BPA and our public power peers on post-2028 contracts. And then, as I already mentioned, we also engage with other smaller groups. We've engaged with a SLICE customer group, the PPC small working group, and a conservation subgroup. So we're attending a lot of meetings just to make sure that we're getting this right for our customers.
Could we go back for a second to slide number 10? Just go back one. Okay, so what happens between December 2025 and May of 2028? What's going on in those 3 years? I mean, there's a lot going on, but it takes 3 years to get all these contractual matters ironed out. Is that right?
Hopefully not. An example of something that did take a while that they could use that time for is in the last contract, they essentially invented the SLICE product. And the SLICE product is a simulated parallel universe of the federal hydro system that exists in a computer program and then is operated by product subscribers of that program. So that really did use up a considerable amount of time to invent the application to make that product work. So I think the intent here is not to box in potential future opportunities by not having enough time to implement them.
So what's actually going on is
potential development of technology tools and interaction with markets that could exist and the rate making constructs and legal review. We have all these pieces that would make that new construct, a new contract, ready to go live on day one.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tony is so pleased that I'm hearing upfront and often going in with a predetermined plan for what is in the best interest of our customers. And this is so different. You referred to the last negotiations, the 20-year contract. And on that, just a final shot here. It did take that long previously. And it was down to the hour that Bonneville flew up here in a private plane to give Snohomish to sign their contract. And I'm so glad that we're not. It's critical. This is critical to our customers for years into the future. And I'm very pleased.
Absolutely. I hope what you leave with is that we understand, you know, the scale of the issue for our customers. We're dedicating appropriate resources to it. We know where we need to focus the most attention. We're being proactive in potential solutions to each of those priority areas. And we're working with our peers to make something that works for us, but also works for the region. Because we need the region to be successful ourselves as well. So that's how we're approaching it. And we look forward to giving you an update as more time passes to hopefully share some great successes.
Thank
you. Yes. Well, I think the approach is right on. I think it makes a lot of sense. And I'm really proud that we're so engaged. We call out PVC a lot for being very engaged. And I think it's important that we have to look at all the products and see how it would work for us. I still have to wonder, as people start signing contracts, someone could be picking one product. If they're a huge customer, they may change and pick a different product, which would change, you know, like Slice, right? It would change. Fewer Slice customers, the more Slice, I would assume, but I don't know. But
yeah.
The math changes, so
it does. Yeah.
It's important to be nimble and make sure all three are.
Well, thank you all for your time and
for both of you and our Zoom presenter. Excellent presentation.
Thank you. Commissioner, can we take a short break for the next one?
We certainly could. It is 10:12 a.m. and we will take a 5-minute break. It is 10:17 and we are reconvened. Pam.
Yes, Commissioner Olson, the last presentation that we have today is Ian Hunter, and he's here to provide an update on our Climate Commitment Act.
Good morning, Commissioners. Ian Hunter, analyst in the Power Supply Department, and I have the unenviable task of following Garrison and Marie, who did a great job presentation-wise. So we're going to do our best. We've got an interesting topic to talk about. We've got the Climate Commitment Act, and we're going to be giving you an update on the community efforts and this legislation. So a little bit of what we're going to be talking about today, we're just going to do a real quick review. It's been a little bit since we've talked about the Climate Commitment Act, or the CCA. Talk about kind of the major points, what the bill actually does. We're going to give you an update on rulemaking that has gone on over the last year or so. We're going to talk about what issues we're discussing the rulemaking, and then what the final rule says, and what impacts it might have on Snohomish. And then, finally, next steps. Where do we go from here? So what is the Climate Commitment Act? And I'm going to be calling it the CCA from now on. Got to get in as many acronyms as we can in the presentations, right? The CCA, it's also known as the Cap and Invest Program here in Washington State. It was passed into law in 2021 by the legislature. It implements a statewide cap on greenhouse gas emissions. The goal is, over time, the program would lower that cap for allowable emissions in the state and thus reduce the amount of economy-wide emissions overall in the state of Washington. Covered entities who are subject to this program have to either acquire allowances to satisfy the compliance obligation of the program or reduce their emissions. So kind of a double-edged sword. You can pay or you can reduce your emissions. The allowances themselves that you would need to acquire in order to comply with the program are provided by the state via auction. And so this provides a source of revenue for the state. So as you can imagine, it was at least a little bit popular in the legislature as a new source of revenue for the state. Overall, there are a total amount of allowances that are provided, the allowances that come through the auction, and then there's no cost allowances that we'll talk about in a little bit. But overall, that those number of allowances do decline, which represents the declining cap, so that the state can meet its emissions target goals.
What are examples of covered entities?
So the program covers any entity in the state that emits 25,000 metric tons of CO2 or more on an annual basis. So that could be businesses, that could be electric utilities, pretty much economy-wide. What are the key milestones for the CCA? So we're recording two. One is a milestone we've already passed, and one is a milestone that's coming up. The first is the Department of Ecology, who is kind of the action agency implementing the CCA. They began their rulemaking on August 4th of 2021 and then concluded it last month, the very end, with the final rule issuance. The next milestone that we're looking at is the program is set to begin January 1st of 2023. So legislation was passed in the 2021 legislative session. The program begins in 2023. That's a pretty quick turnaround for a program of this size. So just not a lot of time to implement and get all their ducks in a row, but that's the next kind of big milestone. The compliance period for this program is 4 years, but in the first compliance period, Ecology is going to be taking it year by year to kind of fine tune and allow for adjustments, recognizing that they had a pretty quick turnaround time from when the legislation was passed and when they had to get this program set up and running. The key provisions. So we talked a little bit about the overall cap. It is economy-wide, so it's not just electric utilities that are being covered. It's any entity that's 25,000 metric tons or more emissions in Washington state. The electric sector specifically, when you think about the point of regulation, in most cases, it's, you know, you're emitting in the state. But electric sector is a little different because we can bring electricity across state lines, which may have carbon content associated with it. So for generators inside the Washington state boundaries, they're directly regulated. They would have a direct compliance obligation to the state under the CCA. For electricity that crosses state boundaries coming in, or for generators outside the state, they have their compliance determined via ETAG. So if you have electricity that has an emissions associated with it, whoever is responsible for bringing that energy across the state line is the one who would incur the compliance obligation. Now, one thing to note is just because you brought it across the state line doesn't mean you're ultimately the entity who used the electricity. Electricity is notoriously difficult to track given that it's electrons and moves at the speed of light. So this is a framework that we're trying to get in place to track those emissions as they cross state borders. In order to comply with the program, entities have to purchase one allowance for every metric ton of CO2 emitted. The overall cap forces entities to either purchase those allowances or reduce emissions and thus not incur a compliance obligation.
Question.
Yes.
How is it measured? I mean, who measures it? How is it measured and tracked?
The Department of Ecology is the action agency responsible for gathering that information. There are rules about greenhouse gas reporting that economy-wide entities have to do, and the electric sector specifically will have rules about how to report our greenhouse gas emissions.
It includes methane?
I believe so, but I don't know for sure. Yeah, the different emitting gases are covered differently by the Department of Ecology. I believe this is mostly covering CO2, but I believe it could have other provisions for different greenhouse gases, which have different impacts on the atmosphere and the environment. What the CCA does is it does recognize that the electric sector is already regulated by the Clean Energy Transformation Act. There's a recognition there, and there is some policies and discussion in the CCA about what that really entails, and we'll go into that in just a minute. And as I mentioned, the Department of Ecology is the action agency responsible for implementing this program. So we just mentioned that the CCA recognizes that CETA exists and is the governing kind of policy for electric utilities. So how do they interact? You would think that they might have some conflict potentially. And we want to talk a little bit about how they actually work in practice. When it was first introduced, there was a significant risk of double regulating. So you might get charged a compliance cost under CETA and also a compliance cost under the CCA for what is essentially the same megawatt of generation. As the CCA was being developed, legislators did recognize that CETA was the primary state policy for transitioning the electric sector away from carbon emitting resources and into kind of your clean energy future. And so they wanted to make sure that that was recognized in the bill and that there were policy protections for utilities so that you didn't get that double regulation effect. The concept that was put forward and made it into the bill was that utilities and ratepayers shouldn't bear any additional costs from the CCA as we're already regulated. The way that this is memorialized in statute is that utilities would receive what are called no cost allowances. So whereas other covered entities have to go out to auction and purchase allowances, utilities would be allocated a share of allowances for free that they could use to offset those costs or mitigate those costs in the program. That way, you're not seeing any increased costs from the CCA being passed, and you're being regulated primarily through CETA and decarbonizing your portfolio through that policy and mechanism.
So then what's the point of having this in CCA? Do all this work and then pay nothing but your staff time
and
figure it all out?
There's a couple reasons. It is an economy-wide bill, and the electric sector does make up a big chunk of the emissions. I believe it was something along the lines of 25%. I've heard that number kicked around. So it would be tough to just lift the electric sector out when you're 25%. The second piece is that the Cap and Invest program has hopes of linking to the California Cap and Invest program or Cap and Trade program. That can provide significant benefits to both programs having linked jurisdictions. And if the electric sector wasn't in the program in Washington, while it is in the program in California, it could potentially make linkage more difficult or not possible. So Washington wanted to see, or at least the legislatures wanted to see, legislators wanted to incentivize linkage to the California program, so they wanted to make sure that the electric sector was covered.
What about our emissions, our non-generating emissions, like our vehicle fleet? Are they covered by this?
The way that the statute reads that I've read so far is that we are primarily covered through our generation portfolio and through our greenhouse gas emissions associated with electricity.
I was thinking about that too. Were you trying to speak?
No, I just said that's interesting.
Yeah, when I think about what we might be doing at the PUD, it would contribute. My first thought is all the transportation, all of our vehicles, big, you know, diesel driven and equipment. I think they're missing by not including that.
And I can check into that to make sure that that's the case. My guess would be is that there's a differentiation between emissions associated with electricity and fleet emissions. And while we may cross that 25,000 metric ton threshold on the electric side, on the fleet side, we wouldn't come close to crossing that threshold.
On the vehicle side, on the fleet side?
Right, on the vehicle side.
I'd love to have a better picture of how they're going to capture the numbers, the metric tons.
Yeah, and this is a high-level presentation meant to just kind of cover the policy in general.
I wouldn't expect to have the answer from you, but I know that there are ways to measure smokestack pollution, things like that, because the companies have to measure that, but they have people who have to do that.
Yes.
To keep track of that. But vehicles? Anyway, thank you.
Yeah. So note on the legislation, Snohomish put in an official position when the legislation was going through the House and the Senate as neutral. We did not formally take a position. So the reason for that was, while we're supportive of economy-wide decarbonization. You know, we want the economy and the electric utility to be as clean as possible. There were issues that still remained in the bill prior to passage. There was this conceptual agreement that utilities shouldn't bear any additional costs from the CCA because we're regulated by CETA, but the actual statutory language in the bill left a lot of latitude for how that would be implemented to rulemaking. So there was concern from the utility community that we'd see problems in the rulemaking where either our costs weren't covered or that there was significant regulatory burden that would be challenging for utilities as we move forward. Even with our 100% clean portfolio moving into the future, we did still see cost and risk, again, pending those final rules, because there's so much left in discretion to rulemaking. And this piece of the cost burden was really the broader utility coalition's focus during rulemaking, which we'll talk about right now. Unless there's any questions on kind of the CCA overview or any other specific questions on the legislation itself. Jump right in. So the rulemaking itself, what were our primary points of engagement? We kind of talked already, our primary focus really was this concept of quote unquote cost burden, which is kind of the statutory term for what costs a utility would incur on behalf of its ratepayers through the CCA. There were a couple of secondary topics. We're not going to cover them in too much depth today. What's the overall baseline? How's that overall cap established? That was discussion, as well as how does Bonneville fit into this? Will they be allowed to be the first jurisdictional deliverer or the entity responsible for the compliance obligation of bringing that energy across state lines for imported electricity? As you know, Bonneville is a federal agency and they cannot be bound by a state's rulemaking action or legislation. So Bonneville would have to choose to be subject to a state law. And there's a question in rulemaking about how that works, whether Bonneville has that option, what's the process, and so on. So because the primary focus was cost burden, that's where we're going to be focusing our time today. It's the largest potential point of contention in our engagement. The final rules regarding cost burden, we're just going to talk about what the final rule actually says. It utilizes a formula based on annual forecasts of your total retail load on one side, and then the resources that you're using to serve that load on the other. So when you're looking at your total retail load, ecology is essentially saying, forecast what resources you're going to use to serve that load, figure out what the emissions are for those resources, and we'll compensate you with no cost allowances for whatever you're forecasting. Those forecasts have to be approved by our governing boards, and can be updated through June of 2023. And then there's going to be potential updates in future years for our future forecasts. The forecasts that we submit do have to be consistent with our published Clean Energy Implementation Plan, which you saw at the end of last year and approved. And then the ecology would be the entity that actually takes that forecasted data, plugs it into the formula, and determines what the cost burden is. So that's not on the utilities plate to determine what our cost burden is. It's ecology who's going to be making that calculation.
So is there a true enough thing for forecast? What about what the actual is?
There is a provision in there for true up, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit. So we'll put a pin in that question. So what are our concerns with this approach? The cost burden formula, as it's established in rules, only accounts right now for direct compliance costs. So the cost that we would have to pay to the state or the allowances we would have to acquire to offset a direct emissions burden. So if you had 100 megawatts or 100 metric tons of CO2 emissions, you'd have to get 100 allowances to offset that. That's a direct compliance cost. Indirect compliance costs would be something like an entity outside the state of Washington decides to sell energy into the state of Washington at the Mid-C hub. They are responsible for bringing the energy across state lines. So they say, all right, I'm gonna get a compliance obligation. There's gonna be an extra cost for me transacting this. So I'm just gonna build that into my market price. So rather than charge the market price of $30 that everyone else is paying, I'm gonna charge $40 and sell it at the market price, and which will have an effect on market prices in general, bringing them up in the Northwest. So when Snohomish buys that energy at Mid-Sea, where we would have previously paid 30, we're now paying 40, which gives us a $10 indirect cost burden. We're not directly paying that to the state, but it's an increased cost as compared to what we would have paid had CCA not gone into effect. So the way the rules are set up now, the formula only captures that direct cost compliance burden and not the indirect cost that we're going to be seeing through our marketing activity and our portfolio. A second concern, unless it's proactively updated, the load and resource forecasts may be taken from inappropriate or inconsistent data sources. The way the rule is set up, there's a hierarchy of data sources the ecology would pull from if utilities take no action to update their forecasts. The first is the CEIP, the second is the IRP, but ecology would be the one actually pulling that data, and we would have no control over what data they're actually pulling in to use in this forecast.
Is that if you don't comply?
That's or- if, so the in the timeline of ecology saying, we're gonna give you no cost allowances, they need a data source to plug into that formula. And if the utility doesn't take a proactive action to say, our governing board approved this forecast or updated this forecast, here's the data, ecology is gonna do a pull rather than us doing a push of data. And when they do that pull, it might be from sources that don't accurately match up with what we're gonna be seeing. A lot of the data sources that they've listed in rules are average annual forecasts, but the compliance mechanism is essentially on an hourly basis. So the data isn't a good representation of the emissions or the compliance burden we would actually see. So you put these two things together, we're not getting potential coverage of indirect costs. We might be seeing forecasts that are coming from not applicable sources. And the result is you could see a significant cost to Snohomish ratepayers despite us being a net exporter of clean energy.
Well, I see where we might end up doing an hour by hour IRP every year, and we'd have that cost burden of staff time to do that to buy them the most reliable forecast.
I think I can hear Garrison sweating behind me. So that's the concern that we have with the cost burden calculation and the rules as established. So what's the alternative? What would we like to see? Snohomish, as part of the public generating pool, put forward a set of comments and a framework for what we think the cost burden calculation should be. We called it a cost burden template. It allows utilities to put the applicable data into a template that would then work through and calculate what we actually think our costs are going to be as a result of CETA. We use the CCA's statutory language as passed by the legislature and the definition of cost burden to make sure that we were consistent with what the statute actually says as we're going through to calculate our costs. So we're not taking costs that aren't covered by the statute. We're not trying to pull in costs to get an extra discount. We're trying to be consistent with the statute and the agreement that was made at the legislature that utilities shouldn't be getting double charged for CETA and CCA compliance. The cost burden template includes both direct and indirect costs of the CCA. It's consistent with California's cap and trade program. So California has a similar kind of cost burden calculation that they do. And the PGP template takes elements from that that template as well so that they're consistent and could actually improve the chances of linkage. And the third is that, you know, it would protect our customers from increased costs under the CCA. So that we're only seeing costs come through our CETA compliance.
Who has authority over, because I know it's part of the administrative part of the state. What kind of oversight is there to make sure that the enforcement is being done properly? And I know that there's connection between the EPA at the federal level and the BPA at the state level. But so if things would change at the federal level, some future administration would say, oh, we don't like that. We're going to, can they annul something that's been passed in our state?
I am not the expert. Generally speaking, the federal government can't supersede state
right.
regulations. And as a utility, we're generally going to be bound by whatever is the most stringent policy that's out there. So if the state has a policy that's ahead of the federal government, we're going to be compliant with the state policy because then we're in compliance with both. If it were the other way around, we'd be in compliance with the federal policy, and then we'd be also in compliance with the state policy. But in this case, the CCA is ahead of the federal government, what the federal government requires. And I would say in terms of oversight, ecology really is kind of the final say on enforcement. There is a relationship with the state auditor's office for auditing to make sure that the covered entities are meeting the requirements of the statute. But ecology and the state auditor's office, I imagine, will work together on that. There's also provisions in the greenhouse gas reporting that utilities have to get third-party audit of the data that you're submitting to ecology. So ecology isn't necessarily going to be having an army of technical experts reviewing the data that's being submitted. It's on the utility to audit the data and then provide the third-party audit proof to the agency. Hopefully that answered your question.
Yes.
Okay.
Didn't make me feel any better, though.
Well, in other contexts that I've worked on, like dairy lagoons and things that are governed by the EPA, they haven't done a very good job of enforcing it. And so that's kind of in the back of my mind, too. Are they prepared to do good enforcement? I mean, not that it would affect our community, but overall, since it is statewide,
I will say that ecology has gotten a significant amount of allocation from the state budget to increase their staffing. Okay. Whether that's going to go more towards program development or enforcement, I couldn't say. But I will say that ecology is ramping up their staffing to facilitate the creation and introduction and running of this program.
I don't need to know utilities. Was there any petition of public power that like this? Rulemaking result? I don't need to know utilities.
I would say, generally speaking, from my understanding, public power is not thrilled with the outcome of the rulemaking. And so that's actually a good lead into next steps.
Okay.
So Snohomish staff is actually working right now so that we can provide the commission with two cost burden calculations. One calculation would be following the strict letter of the rulemaking. Here's what, you know, the final rule language says the cost burden calculation would be. Here's what we plug into the formula. Here's one number for the cost burden. The second would be a detailed calculation using the PGP cost burden template, which is what we think the cost burden should be under the statute. Both calculations would use the same underlying data. We're not going to be cherry picking data for each calculation. We want to make sure we're consistent, but we want to give the commission kind of that delta number between the two so that there can be kind of a discussion around, here's what the rule says, here's what we think our interpretation is, what do we want to provide back to ecology as our forecast. That highlighting of those costs and kind of juxtaposing them is the next step to kind of say, here's what the real impact of the final rule is to Snohomish. And here's what the costs of the CCA are versus, you know, what the statutory language says and what that agreement was for CCA versus CETA costs. We're currently pulling that data together. As I mentioned, the rule was passed September 30th, so we're still in process of getting that data together and getting those calculations ready. Our hope is that we will be using the most up-to-date data, including future market prices, forecasted allowance prices. So because the program hasn't actually started yet, we don't know what each of those allowances is gonna cost. Department of Ecology has done some forecasting work. We'll probably also take a look at California data to see how their auction prices have evolved over time. But the forecast allowance prices do play into how we would be compensated for our cost burden. We'd also be looking at load and resource balancing costs as well to factor into the PGP cost template. We're hoping to provide this analysis by the end of the year. As we mentioned, the program starts January 1, and so we want to make sure that we can get data back to ecology in a timely manner, especially if we're going to be using forecasted data from a different source that the commission would be approving. Any questions?
Wow. It's always like, you know, I think we have the audit too. We'll have to pay for the audit. If this, so we'll have the renewable audit, the seed audit, this audit. This is really intended to no more cost burden on us.
There are a number of state policies to which we are beholden.
Yeah. Thank you for working on this.
Thank you.
Thank you again.
Do we have any other presentations this morning?
No, that's the final presentation.
All right, thank you. It is 10:45 a.m. and the meeting will be recessed and we will reconvene in the commission meeting room at 1:30 p.m. Thank you.